Charles Merrill Mount was a name I did know. For years, he had been a prominent sergeant specialist. He had written a biography of Sargent, and his expert opinion was often sought for the authentication of paintings thought to be by Sargent. That is, until it was discovered that he was authenticating Sargents that he himself had painted. "You mean the Charles Merrill Mount who went to jail?" I said. "Yes." I said that I thought it was pretty impressive to have a portrait of oneself painted by a master forger of Sargent paintings, based on a portrait by Anders Zorn, painted in the same place Zorn had painted his original. As I looked at the portrait, it occurred to me that Charles Merrill Mount had captured Patricia in more than one sense. He had pulled her into the artistic history of the house, back into the late 19th century, to the era of Sargent, Henry James, and Isabella Stewart Gardner. I could only guess how strongly she identified with that glorious past through this painting, and whether the white dress had anything to do with her always wearing white. "There's another room on this floor that I think might interest you," she said. She opened the door to a long, narrow room with a low, vaulted ceiling. Bookcases lined the walls, and between them, on three sides, rays of sunlight streamed in and fell in pools of amber on the terrazzo floor. Much older and far more decorative than the rest of her apartment, this library was like a slice carved out of the Piano Nobile and brought up here for safekeeping. This was the room that the servant Angelo had sealed off during the Second World War so that nobody who lived in the palace knew it was there. It was a gem of a room, and it would still be hers even when the Piano Nobile was not. No 2-to-1 vote could take it away. "One summer," she said, "when Isabella Stewart Gardner rented the palace from my great-grandparents, she had a house full of guests, including Henry James, and she ran out of bedrooms. So she put an extra bed up here for James. He loved gazing up at the stucco and the paintings on the ceiling, and he wrote my great-grandmother a letter about it to tell her what she, the owner of the palace, had been missing if she hadn't slept in this room herself." She lifted a piece of paper out of a book and read, "Have you ever lived here? If you haven't gazed upward from your couch in the rosy dawn or during the postprandial, that is, after luncheon siesta, at the medallions and arabesques of the ceiling, permit me to say that you don't know the Barbaro." She slipped the letter back into the book. "When I was 14, my father called us up here after school was finished for the semester. He sat at that desk over there and handed out books he wanted us to read over the summer. He gave me The Wings of the Dove."
"You were 14?
"I'll admit, I found it difficult, but having read it, I can understand why for some people, no matter who owns the Barbaro, it will always belong to Millie Teal. In fact," she said as we started back downstairs, "Millie Teal will be returning to the Barbaro in a few months."
"How so?" I asked.
"An English film company is coming to make the movie of The Wings of the Dove." Patricia's mood seemed to brighten at the rightness of it. The Curtises had allowed footage for a dozen or more films to be shot inside the Barbaro, films that had no connection at all with the Barbaro. It seemed fitting that this one, which had everything to do with the Barbaro and the Curtises, would be the last under the ownership of the Curtis family. I recalled a bit of dialogue from the book that made it all the more poignant, and I wondered if the thought had occurred to Patricia as well. "Millie has moved into Palazzo Laparelli and has fallen in love with it. She clings to it, never wants to leave. She tells Lord Mark, 'I go about here. I don't get tired of it. I never should. It suits me so. I adore the place. I don't want in the least to give it up.'"
"Should you positively like to live here?"
"I think I should like," said poor Millie after an instant, "to die here."